Will the House come to order? Will the members please indicate their presence by voting? Has any member failed a vote? The clerk, please tally the board.
24 members present.
We have a quorum present to conduct business. Mr. Majority Leader.
Mr. Speaker, Representative Schultz, Binkley, and Adams are excused from the call of the House. Representative Sun from noon, Representative Jenkins from 4 p.m. on.
Our chaplain today is Pastor Milton S. Hunt. Would the members please rise for the invocation?
Let us pray. O Lord God, designer of the universe, we give you thanks for all the vastness and variety of this great land. We rejoice in the multiplicity of terrains found along the Iditarod Trail, from city streets to mountain passes, from river valleys to the frozen sea. We give you thanks for the growing life along the rail belt, from the lush vegetation along the sea, through the alpine growth, to the miniature forest in the interior. We praise you for the animals of Alaska, especially along the route of the oil pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez, with caribou, moose, wolves, and many other mammals. We honor you for the sea life discovered along the Alaska Marine Highway in the Panhandle, with whales and porpoises and majestic eagles soaring overhead. We also marvel at the varieties of people that have come to our state from other states and many countries and several continents. Give wisdom to this assembled body that they may legislate for the greater good of our entire Alaska, for all life and growing things. We each pray in our own manner, but many join me in praying in the spirit of that teacher of lilies and birds, Jesus of Galilee. Amen.
Representative Gruenberg, would you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Representative Pinyalberry.
Mr. Speaker, I move unanimous consent that today's prayer be spread upon the journal.
Are there any objections as having the prayer spread upon the journal? Hearing no objections, so ordered. Would the clerk at this time please certify the journal for the 52nd and 53rd legislative day?
As chief clerk, I certify as to the correctness of the journal for the 52nd and 53rd days in House Supplement number 94.
Mr. Majority Leader.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the journal for the 52nd and 53rd days and House Supplement number 94 be approved as certified.
Hearing objections to the motion, Mr. Minority Leader.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to ask if we can reserve approving House Journal Supplement number 94 until the part of our calendar of unfinished business. At that time, I would like to discuss part of the journal where there may be assumptions made that perhaps we should correct before we approve the journal, if that be allowed.
In other words, the minority leader is requesting that the 52nd day of the journal be held.
House Supplement number 94, which does include the 52nd day, yes, sir.
Perhaps it might be cleaner, Mr. Majority Leader, if you just withdraw the motion and then we'll recess. Representative Clarkson.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent I be allowed to withdraw my motion on the approval of the journal and the journal supplements.
Any objections? Hearing no objections, the motion has been withdrawn. Seeking a motion to recess, Representative Clarkson.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to have the clerk reflect that Representative Boucher is ill today and therefore excused. Mr. Speaker, I move that the House stand in recess to the call of the chair.
At ease. Would the members in the chambers come to order? In accordance with the uniform rules, during a joint session, the presiding officer of the Senate presides. Mr. President.
Will the joint session please come to order? The purpose of the joint session is an address by the Honorable Ted Stevens, United States Senior Citizen for Alaska. Senator Halford.
Mr. President, I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call of the Senate be waived and all members of the Senate be shown as present.
Without objection, so ordered. Representative Clarkson.
Mr. President, I move and ask unanimous consent the roll call of the House be waived and all members of the House be shown as present.
Without objection, so ordered. Senator Halford.
Mr. President, in Gallery A behind me, I'd like to introduce Senator Stevens' daughter, Susan Covey.
Will Representative Frank and Senator Kelly escort the Honorable Ted Stevens to the joint session?
Ladies and gentlemen, all rise for the Honorable Ted Stevens, United States Senate. Stevens, United States Senior Senator for the state of Alaska.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, I don't know who put you up to that, Mr. President. Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, it's nice to be with you in the ladies and gentlemen, legislature, thank you for permitting me to be here again. I had a conversation with one of your members this morning about the fact that I do have one of those hunting licenses that you all have made available to some of us old-timers, but I didn't think I was that old. But it's nice to be here as a senior senator or a senior citizen. Either one, I know that some of the senior citizens are in town, and it's pleasant to look back in the back of the house and see my daughter, Susan, who reminds me so much of her mother. I thank you, Susie, for coming down. You know, there's one word that will be used so often this year that I predict there's going to be an avalanche of new words or phrases to replace it. It's one we've all heard too much, deficit. Not a new word, but one with a new global significance. Because we've all heard about the United States deficit, but few have paid much attention to deficits throughout the world. Let me take just a few minutes of yours to comment on some of those. For instance, Canada now has a $30.4 billion deficit. Country much smaller than ours. If we had a deficit that size, similar in size to Canada's, our United States deficit would be a whopping $260 billion this year. It's about $100 billion less than that, as you know. Recent analysis of the Soviet budget indicates with the decline of oil prices, additional pressure is already on the Soviet Union's beleaguered economy. Great Britain has a £10.2 billion deficit, and perhaps the worst news of all is that the deficit of Saudi Arabia. For the fourth year now, the Saudis will run a deficit. Experts I've talked with predict the Saudi 1986 deficit close to $30 billion at a $14 oil price. And as you know, yesterday it went below that. Now, the Saudis have had deficits of $15 to $20 billion for the last 3 years. They've got a reserve fund similar to our permanent fund, and they also have worldwide investments that exceed $80 billion. So they're not broke, but the real point is that they have a cash flow deficit pattern, and it's a bad one. I see some of my old friends here saying, you know, what's Stevens doing talking about deficits? We don't have a deficit in Alaska, and that's right, so far. So far we don't. But just think about these deficits. Canada is our largest trading partner. Few people realize that we trade more with our Canadian neighbors than with all other nations of the world combined. Their deficit means their dollar will continue to maintain a low exchange rate to ours, leaving us with a continued imbalance in the value of our trade. Canada will continue to export to us, to increase their exports to us, but they will earn less in terms of their currency from those exports. And the Saudis are in a similar position, and this is important to us. If they increase their oil production to try to increase their income, oil prices worldwide would be further lowered. And the great problem for the Saudis is there's already an oversupply in the world, what is known as an overhang in the market, and they must eventually reduce production, not increase it. I thought I'd report to you about some visits I had in London recently when I was overseas as a member of the Senate Observer Group for the arms control talks. I arranged briefings from two international oil companies on worldwide energy problems. Both of those companies' experts saw declining demand worldwide for petroleum in the second quarter of this year. One postulated that there would be a reduction in production so that this second quarter decline was really no problem. The other predicted an increase in the overhang on the market. If the first was right, the current oil price decline will be short-lived and really no problem. If the second was correct, God only knows how low the price of oil will go before someone, some country, will drastically reduce production to correct the imbalance between supply and demand in the world. The second company's economist indicated, and I don't think he had read Mr. Tusing's paper, he indicated he would not be surprised by a $5 oil price by the end of this year. I'm sure you would all agree that would be bad news for Alaska, real bad news. If it occurred, then Alaskans would know what deficit really means. But it would not be bad news for the country. And that, I think, is something we have to understand. With the price of oil declining, the value of the dollar worldwide receding, inflation continuing at a low level, and interest rates coming down to the late 1960s level, our federal deficit may now be more manageable than had previously been predicted. I know that you've heard statements that Congressman Young has made in Washington, Senator Murkowski made here about the federal deficit and about Graham Rudman Hollings. So let me take just a minute of your time to talk about Graham Rudman Hollings as I understand it. That amendment was added to a five-year plan to reduce the federal deficit to zero by 1991. I was there when that plan was formulated. Originally, it was a three-year plan, and I suggest it would not have gotten us to zero, and I suggested we ought to extend it to 5 years to 1991 to make it zero. The problem was we didn't have any mechanism to make certain that the targets, the maximum deficit ceilings in that plan would be met. As Senator Murkowski pointed out to you when he was here, the Graham Rudman Hollings Amendment was action taken by the Congress in response to resolutions such as you here in our state legislature sent to us, demanding the federal government balance its budget. And even assuming we do balance the budget by 1991, we still have the massive problem, which I spoke to you about last year, the federal debt. We estimate it would still be, then in 1991, at least $2.4 trillion, with interest running at $200 billion annually. But the Graham Rudman Hollings Amendment is what's taking the attention of the nation now. It's been called many things by many people. It's been severely criticized and highly praised. I do not use it either as a whipping post or as an altar. It is really neither. It is a mechanism for discipline adopted by a Congress which represents a society divided by a multitude of interests and regional problems. The sooner that everyone realizes that Graham Rudman Hollings is not a solution, but a device to attempt to assure a solution, the better off we'll all be. And members of state legislatures throughout the country, which and I believe wisely, demanded that Congress balance the federal budget, must accept the fact, the sure fact, that such action will reduce federal assistance to states in almost every segment of our economy. And it's not just an assistance to the states. Even in the defense area, there are shifting priorities. While many people don't realize it, Congress has already cut $153 billion out of President Reagan's 1981 projected defense spending plan. Last year alone, our Appropriations Committee cut $35 billion from the President's original 1986 defense budget. We will, I hope, be careful that we don't delete in our budget process systems that are on the table in Geneva at the arms control talks. For when we left Geneva recently, I had a feeling of optimism for the first time. The Soviets have indicated now, as you know, that INF, the Intermediate Nuclear Force, those negotiations can go forward without linkage to our Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI. And while there's been no positive results so far, our negotiators in Geneva believe that real negotiations on INF will commence this year. Now, since I've been in the Senate and in my appearances here before this legislature, I've tried to alert the nation and our state to the increase in Soviet offensive armaments in the Soviet Far East. Not many people realize that there are now more Soviet naval vessels in the Pacific than the United States maintains worldwide. And the Soviets now have 57 divisions, 57 full divisions in the Soviet Union east of the Ural Mountains in the Soviet Far East. As a consequence, the Department of Defense is now moving, as you know, to improve the defense of Alaska and to protect the vital national missions that many of our Alaska military installations perform. We have all seen now the F-15s, our first line defensive fighter, come to Alaska along with A-10s, the Army's favorite close support aircraft. And now we will have AWACS, the Airborne Warning and Control System, come to Elmendorf, together with a KC-135 Air National Guard tanker unit at Eielson. Those new units complement the new 6th Light Division, which we will activate later this month at Fort Wainwright, with supporting units at Fort Richardson. All of these will add to our Alaska economy, but I want to assure you that's not the reason they're coming here. Well, I think we must continue to remind everybody of General Billy Mitchell's advice, and I quote his statement, "Alaska is the most central place in the world for aircraft, and that is true either of Europe, Asia, or North America," he declared. "I believe in the future he who holds Alaska will hold the world, and I think it is the most strategic place in the world." Now, finally, that is coming home to the defense planners of this country. And let me point out that when, hopefully, we achieve this new series of agreements with the Soviets to radically reduce nuclear armaments, intermediate and long-range nuclear missiles, as well as chemical weapons, increased monitoring and surveillance will be necessary to assure compliance by the Soviets with those agreements. Alaska is uniquely located for such missions, and we in all probability will see increased military units stationed here if there is success in Geneva. This year's defense expenditures in Alaska are budgeted at $1.3 billion, including about $300 million in military construction primarily associated with the Light Division. And despite what you're hearing, there are increased federal expenditures in this state this year. Even the post office will continue its improvement of Alaska facilities, adding to the past few years a program. This year will reach the point of about $100 million spent in modernization of postal facilities, 99% of which were completed by Alaska architects, engineers, contractors, and workmen. I hasten to point out to you that I've tried my best to bring the Postmaster Generals to Alaska to help them see the necessity for this modernization program. The new Postmaster General, Al Casey, will be in North Pole on May 28 to dedicate 4 Arctic Explorer commemorative stamps. Many of you have helped me greet those postal officials when they come to the state. I hope you'll help me greet the new Postmaster General Al Casey when he comes in so we can continue this process of educating the people in Washington as to the need for this modernization. Now, you and I are not without our mutual problems, and I've not discussed those as I have in the past at length. Rather, I'd rather see what aspects of them you're interested in. I think of issues such as sovereignty, 1991, the sale of the Alaska Power Administration, federal housing, education, health, and social expenditures in Alaska, fisheries issues, the future of the oil and gas development in the Arctic, wildlife national refuge, environmental problems, federal tax levels as they affect Alaska, transportation, tourism, Winter Olympics. There are many others that I've worked on with members here in the state legislature and would be happy to discuss. You may have others you want to pursue, and to the extent that the President and the Speaker will make time available, I'll be pleased to try and answer any of your questions. When I sat here, the last time I sat was right there in the state legislature. I remember my predecessors, the prior senators from Alaska, coming here to the legislature and giving a speech, but they weren't given an opportunity to respond to questions. It was not until 1969 when I first returned here as a former member, having left here in 68, before a joint session, that I asked the leadership if there were questions that I might try to answer. And from that occasion has grown a unique Alaskan practice, these annual appearances before you to permit me to make comments and to try to answer your questions. I think you might be interested to know that other states have heard of this practice and are now following it. It's quite similar to the Canadian practice, as you know, of having members of their parliament who are actually members of the government appear before them to answer questions. I predict the time is coming now that presidents and cabinet officers will find a reason to come before Congress for similar sessions. For as you know, the Senate now, after 10 years of urging by Senator Baker and me and others, has finally joined the House and permitted television from the United States Senate. Openness and public scrutiny is essential, I think, to the preservation of our democracy, and I think part of that process ought to be a question and answer period such as we've had here in the past. So I thank you for permitting me to be part of your open proceedings and would be happy to welcome your comments. But let me make one final thing, and that is Catherine asked me to be sure to say that we were pleased to read that the mayor of Juneau is back on board and that the governor is back jogging. We, whether you realize or not, get sort of annual reports, periodic reports as to the health of our leaders in Alaska, even in the Washington press. So we're happy to see that they're back. I'm sorry that one of my good friends here, Red Boucher, is ill, is not with us, but I do appreciate the opportunity to be with you. Thank you very much, Mr. President, Mr. Speaker. If you have questions, we'll be glad to answer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Stevens, I've learned in my short tenure here that optimistic is a feeling I usually get just before realistic. And relative to the salmon interception negotiations between this country and Japan, that definitely is the case. I wonder if you might upgrade us on the status of those negotiations on high seas salmon interception.
Well, until yesterday, I was pessimistic about this eighth round of negotiations that were going on. As a matter of fact, Mr. Lauber has had a conversation with Tokyo. I've just had a conversation with Washington about the negotiations yesterday. There appears to be a break in the negotiations, and perhaps the pessimistic statement I made when I left Washington on Wednesday can now be modified a little bit and be a little more optimistic. We are seeking, as you know, to move the line. We're seeking to try and assure that there will be greater cooperation on law enforcement, and we're trying to find a way to move the Japanese away from this tremendous damage they do to our North American stocks by high seas interception of salmon. We now realize we're not going to be able to do that all at once, and we had a meeting with our U.S. negotiators before they went to the eighth round, and we agreed upon a fallback position, which apparently they have put forward in Japan, and apparently the Japanese reacted favorably to it. It will involve a movement of the line, although a very slight movement, and it will involve increased activity as far as enforcement is concerned. I continue to believe that the high seas interceptions are bad, but that probably the worst thing we've got are these nets. And that I had a series of hearings last October at which we brought forward proof that there's probably a 1,000 miles of ghost nets that have been cut loose by the Japanese high seas fishery that intercepts our salmon. Those nets become phantom nets. They continue to drift with the tide and wind conditions. They've even known to come up on the beach and ensnarl thousands of birds that are along the beach and then be blown back out to sea. And when they've been picked up, they've had everything from land birds to ocean mammals to, and even worse, we estimate a terrible damage as far as the salmon population. Those nets probably are taking more salmon now than the high seas fishery does that's still active, that are still bringing in their nets. So I'm hopeful that one of the things we will get from the Japanese, and instantly the Taiwanese and the Koreans are apparently using these monofilament nets too, is some understanding of this. When we were meeting with the Canadians last weekend, Senator Murkowski and I got the members of the Canadian Parliament to agree to take back to their Parliament the urgent message that we work together on these nets. I'm working on legislation now that we'll see if we can't put up some kind of a reward to those boats that bring in these nets. So we can try to see if we can't find some identification to find out who is cutting them loose and proceed legally to try and recover damages from the vessels that have cut them loose. It is, to me, I think, the worst thing in the oceans today are these marauding ghost nets. But the short answer to your question is that I am more optimistic today than I was just Wednesday over the future of the eighth round of the negotiations on salmon interception in the high seas.
Representative Pierce.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator, I want to thank you for being here today. Tort reform and insurance reform are both issues that we have been dealing with this year. I don't think there's anyone in the state that hasn't been affected by the problem. I understand that Senator McConnell has introduced some legislation in Congress. We've had over 30 hours of hearings on all the bills that we have, and we've been told by some of the experts that we should wait for the federal legislation, and I'm wondering if you would comment on that, please.
Well, I don't think you should wait, and I think under the McCarran Act, we primarily left to the states the whole question of insurance and regulation of insurance, and it will be too bad if we're forced on the national level to deal with this problem. I think it is a national problem in scope, but it primarily hits state by state, and it's more aggravated in some states than others, and I think it's worse in our state than probably any other state in the Union. I had reports that over half of the fishing vessels of our fleets could not leave port this year initially because of lack of insurance. I know at least one doctor that I've known for years who is a fairly young man compared to some senior citizen I know, and he has retired from practice because he said he was just tired of working so long just for enough money to pay his insurance policy. And I am a lawyer, you know. I've been a lawyer for many years. I believe that the legal profession has a role to play in protecting the rights of individuals who are injured, but I also think that this process has gotten out of hand. And I have told that to the legal profession. They don't like me very much for it, but there are some of us that, if the states do not act, are going to be forced to proceed on the national level, and if we do that, it will be both the legal profession and the insurance industry that will suffer, because we've had a stronger industry, I think, insurance industry on a state-by-state basis than we would if it was it was national in scope. And I think that the attorneys themselves will find that the national reaction will be more sweeping than the total net effect of individual state action. So I don't comment on your legislation, as you know, but I believe in terms of timing of that action that you should not wait. However, I do predict that if the states do not act, we will act. And my fear is when that action comes, states will lose some of their powers over the insurance field necessarily because of the regulatory impact of the proposed federal legislation.
Senator Booth.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Stevens, how can the Congress and the Senate even possibly consider cutting the defense budget after what you just told us today, that there are 57 divisions sitting on the east of Russia? The Russia's been building up for the last 40 years, and you know it, and those people back there know it. How can they cut, and I think I heard you say, $180 billion out of the defense budget? Now, to have a nice little statement. It's like pouring a cup of water, and I did that differently. You cast on a channel to raise the level of the water when the Russians are sitting over there, and for 4 years, build up those 57 divisions, build up their needs. I felt pretty good when I walked in here until I heard you tell you that. They all the short reform, all of the subsistence, all of the oil problems we have, and throw it out the window. If we haven't got a strong defense system for the rest of our nation, I cannot understand the wisdom of those people in Washington. Is there anything you can do to wake them up?
Well, Mitch, I appreciate what you're saying. I'm one of those who did it, though. I want to make sure you understand that I'm chairman of that subcommittee and have made the basic recommendations, and I would say that the levels I have recommended in the last, this is the sixth year that I have been the chairman of that subcommittee, have been the higher levels, not much higher than the House. So that levels that we've attained have been primarily because of those that I've recommended. I don't want to leave with you with the impression that we are defenseless. We are part of a worldwide, a free world group. We are the leader of the free world in defense strategy, but we are joined by very, very potent partners who assist us in the defense of the free world. And the divisions that the Soviets have in the Soviet Far East are not as much addressed to Alaska as they are to China and to the problems that they face in the Far East from a point of view of the highly populated countries and nations of that part of the world. But they have a standing army that is so large it staggers your imagination. They are turning out tanks at the rate of about 8,000 a year. We turn out about 800 a year. Our production rates are very different. And the costs to their economy are much different. Remember, as you think about the Soviet Union, that the Soviet Union is a military power. It is not an economic power. It does not have a worldwide stance economically. It only has a worldwide stance militarily. And therefore, it is putting literally its gross national product into defense. We are putting our gross national product into innovation and high technology and development, some of it associated with defense. Many people hear about our SDI. I wonder if you realize that SDI represents about 1.4% of the total defense budget. It's a great commitment of money, don't misunderstand me. But our commitment to expansion and to modernization compared to the Soviets is not that great. But we have the capability of defending this country today, and we want to maintain it, Mitch. Our goal in Geneva is to try and reduce the costs to both superpowers of this maddening arms race. And for the first time, we see indications that perhaps the Soviets realize the extent of damage that they've done to their own economy by maintaining the production rates militarily that they have over the last 10 years. And if we're right, we're going to see some new arms reductions. Remember, up to this time, we've only seen arms limitations agreements, which have led to increased production, not less. But I don't mean to leave you, old friend, with the thought that you ought to worry tonight about whether we're capable of defending this country. We have that capability. We have that sure capability. We have a triad, you know, land, air, and sea, and they're very capable, and they're on alert 24 hours a day. The whole scope of them have the capability of defending this country. It alarms me to see, as I said, the movement from the western part of the Soviet Union to the eastern part. They really have moved. When I went to the Senate, there were very little in terms of defensive capability in the eastern part of the Soviet Union. And when we first had our first agreements with the Soviets and defined an ICBM, it was a missile that could go from Murmansk to Maine. And I remember when SALT II came before the Senate at a classified thing, I think I told you, a classified hearing, I asked them, well, what about the distance between Siberia and Alaska, or Siberia and Calgary, or Siberia and Colorado Springs? What about that? Has that been taken into account in SALT II? And they said, why? They really did. Their first question is, why should we? And I said, well, look what's there. And they really hadn't paid any attention to what was moving into the Soviet East Coast. So that they have the capability now with backfire bombers, short-range missiles, not ICBMs, and that's now complicating this whole thing. One of the reasons I'm in this Arms Control Observer Group, because as I told one of the Soviet ambassadors the other day, we had an extended argument about the position of the president on SS-20s in the Soviet Far East. As you know, the president has, at my urging and others, insisted that those SS-20s be counted in terms of this overall question of reduction of SS-20s, and it should be worldwide, not just the Western Europe SS-20s that would be reduced in numbers under the agreement. And this is the Soviet ambassador saying, you know, that's none of your business. Those missiles are there for our reasons that don't concern you. And I said, hey, you know, they could go past my home a long way. You know, none of them have focused in to the relationship of Eastern Russia to the Western part of the United States. Now, I think the president as a Westerner has got that focus rearranged, and I believe we'll have a pretty good agreement come out of this. But don't worry about us, my friend. the military strength of the United States has not been reduced. It has been improved in the last few years, and we do have a readiness we have not had before. And I've made some comments to people from Fairbanks about the quality of the U.S. Army now. 90%+ of the U.S. Army are high school graduates. The crime rate is down, either on or off post. AWOL is practically zero. 52% of the young Army people are married. We've got a family orientation towards the Army now, and that new unit in Fairbanks is going to be new neighbors and good neighbors and good citizens. I think it's a different concept. We've got very high-tech Army, too, of necessity. They're dealing with a different kind of a weapon system than we did in our day. So don't worry, Mitch.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Stevens, I'd like to thank you and the congressional delegation for the fine efforts that you've made on behalf of my beleaguered timber industry in southeast Alaska. I'd also like to thank you for the efforts that you made on trying to secure some financing for the new and innovative pollution control devices necessary for the Sitka pulp mill, and it was unfortunate we were unable to obtain that financing. However, we in the state are presently considering assistance to that timber industry in financing through a loan guarantee, and I was wondering if you could give us some advice on how to handle this matter.
Well, Robin, you know, as one lawyer to another, free advice is worth what you pay for it. I don't know what I should get into that as to what you should do, what the state should do. I don't think that's my pocket. I would defend what I did in trying to get government money, federal money, to try out that anaerobic process on the scale that was proposed at Sitka. And I decry the opposition that we got, which was not was closed in a wolf's costume from the environmental spectrum, but it was really opposition from their competitors, economic competitors, that broke the back of the assistance group from Washington in Washington D.C. I believe that we made a real firm commitment at the time of the Alaska Lands Act that the timber economy of southeastern Alaska would not be harassed to death. The thing that bothers me the most is that the people who brought forth the figures, and we talked about this yesterday, the figures are in the Alaska Lands Act as to how much timber can be cut from the Tongass and the production rates. And the Tongass Timber Fund, those suggestions came from the environmental community in order to justify the withdrawal of additional wilderness acres in the Tongass. And it was a compromise we had to accept in order to preserve at least the then level of timber production in the Tongass. What's going on now is harassment from every single side on this timber industry as it tries to survive in a very poor economy nationally and internationally. And I think that all Alaskans should do everything they can to maintain a diversified economy, particularly in southeastern Alaska. And it seems to me that, while not getting involved in what you have to do, I believe the state should do what it can do to assist to preserve that production base. Because the economies are coming back. I mentioned the deficits. What I didn't mention was the correction efforts, the difference in the exchange rates, as I mentioned, the things that are changing now worldwide to me means that we may be entering back into a new plateau as far as a fairly good economy worldwide for a period of years going in to the end of the century. If that's right, timber demand will be up. The necessity to have good a good understanding here in Alaska as to is the meaning of this timber industry will be there. And above all, I see Bill looking at his watch. Above all, the problem I would slide over from that question on, Robin, is beware of the round log syndrome. You know, there's people who say it's all right to cut logs and export them, but it's not all right to cut logs and process them in the state. And that comes from the same environmental sources. I can't understand that position, that we can cut logs to export them, but we can't cut logs to process them. And I believe that we should insist on primary manufacture of our resources in every single area we can.
Senator Stojkowski?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Arliss, because let me tell you, I'll be glad to talk to any of you about 1991 legislation. I tried yesterday for a little bit of time, and it may be that we might have to have a sort of a semi-retreat between those of us who have to handle that bill and those of you who have to meet our mutual constituents to defend what you have or haven't done with regard to that before the bill finally comes up in the Senate. Sovereignty is not involved in the 1991 legislation. I've insisted that it not be. And I still say sovereignty in this state is going to continue to be an issue, and be an issue until the state, and that includes you and the governor, agree to sit down with the congressional delegation and representatives of the Native people and try to meet the needs that they're expressing for local government in terms of traditional Indian concepts. They don't have that yet, and we've not ever address that problem totally, but before the native versus non-native issues in Alaska settle down, we're going to have to do that. But the 1991 legislation is necessary, in our judgment, because of some fears that have been raised in the native community, particularly fears of taxation of their vast unimproved lands that were part of the land grant of the Alaska Native Land Claim Settlement Act. And as I pointed out to three of you yesterday, I think we all have to keep in mind that this was the first time in the history of the world that Aboriginal claims were settled by legislation rather than by adjudication. We settled the Alaska Native Land Claims with a massive act that authorized the conveyance of about 45 million acres of land and the payment of $1 billion, over half of which was paid by this legislature in terms of the cash to settle those claims. Now, the impact of that is that these people have lands by act of Congress, which they, if they had been South 48 Indians, they would have obtained by judicial decree with a series of precedents that would follow the settlement that they got judicially. There are no precedents here, and we have to keep making sure that what we did is consistent with their rights. I don't think any Alaskan would like to see the day when a corporate raider would come to Alaska and for a few million dollars buy the rights to millions of acres of land and the potential of billions of barrels of oil. Now, that is possible after 1991 if we don't act. We have to protect these corporations from raids, and we have to give these people the chance now, after 20 years, to decide whether they want to accept the mechanism that I helped create, the corporate structure, to manage their affairs. Those are not government corporations. They're corporations, village corporations to manage land, and regional corporations to manage subsurface rights and cash. But that was the mechanism we sought, primarily because we wanted to try and help these Native people of Alaska, thoroughly familiar with the economic concepts that apply to our free enterprise economy, and I think they've done one tremendous job. Just think of that. We've had the first bankruptcy or first petition in bankruptcy filed in 15 years, And those were corporations that were created by an act of Congress. I challenge you to find anywhere else in the economy that you had that many corporations survived without calamity, when they in fact were managing assets that they suddenly came into their possession. This act has been successful in my mind, and many of them think they will leave the corporate structure and go back to tribal organization. I have warned them about that, and I hope you all will think of the warning. You pass laws concerning corporations. You pass no laws concerning tribes. The precedents for tribes are in the South 48, not based on Alaska law. And I've told them, you know, you want to call yourself a tribe, okay, call yourself a tribe instead of a village corporation. But remember that the Alaska law that protects the business structure is the corporate law. It's the law regulating businesses, and no legislature is going to pass a discriminatory law against a village or regional corporation because you can't. But a legislature might find a way to restrict a tribal entity that owns substantial amounts of land or administered substantial amounts of cash. Now, they can be a trust, but we didn't create a trust. We created corporations. But this is a very complex law, and I defend what's in there probably more than the others, because I was there in 1971. Frank and Don were not. So if the public of Alaska or you really have serious questions about this, I think you ought to address them to me. The continuity factor is in me and my staff, and I think that from my point of view, what we're trying to do is really trying to carry out the original intent of Congress, and that was to create native collective ownership, but to give them a mechanism for management that would fit into the free enterprise economy. And we are preserving that in this bill, but giving them the option, if they wish, now to return to tribal ownership. But that return to tribal ownership to manage assets does not convey to them any government powers. The powers of local government in this state were turned over to the state of Alaska by the Statehood Act. Nothing in this bill will breathe additional life into any claim for government powers that has been made by any IRA or tribal organization. Now, that is not to say that one of these days I may not appear before you and defend the fact that some of these people do in fact have tribal status, or do in fact have some government powers by virtue of IRAs that were created before we became a state. I think as a lawyer now, again, that's free legal advice to somebody, but I think that there are some rights there that have not been fully articulated yet by a court, and I hope we don't have to get to the point where each one of them has to go to court, because that would just do what would have happened anyway in the pre-land claim settlement days. We anticipated almost 150 suits. We anticipated that we would not be able to get rights away, permanent rights away, across any area for pipelines, or would we get that clear title to any state selections. And I recall as a lawyer writing a title opinion based on a right that was claimed on the basis of a state selection, and I took exception to it because of the existence of land claims that had been asserted by one organization to the land that the state had selected. That Land Claims Act cleared the title to the Alaska state lands. And as such, we took on the obligation to see to it that their title is protected, and that their aboriginal concepts have a chance to survive in the state. Now, you may not agree with that, but that's the position we have taken.
Senator Victor Fisher?
Ted, on a somewhat lighter note, how do you feel, what is your opinion of the claim that Wrangel Island is part of the United States and other Russians might be acclimated?
Yeah, Vic, why don't you send your little girl in to ask me a question? She wouldn't. It would have been lighter, you know. I have almost as much mail about that issue, Vic, that I have about 1991. And my mind goes back to the time when I was the assistant to the Secretary of Interior when we were seeking statehood. And I was also the legislative counsel at that time, the one who reviewed all legislation for the Department of Interior. And I distinctly remember Fred Seaton saying to me, "Are you sure we've included in this legislation every acre of land that the federal government has any claim to that's associated with the territory of Alaska?" And we went back and went over it. I had everybody in the department look again. As we, our position was that any single thing that the United States had a claim to in this area was going to go to the state of Alaska. And my answer to the people who have written to me about the Wrangell Islands, and there are lots of islands out there, you know, it's not just Wrangell, there's several islands, has been that we knew of the association of Alaskans with those islands, but none of them had ever come forward and made a claim on behalf of the United States that was asserted and approved by the federal government saying that this was American territory. If it had been done, it would have been added to the territory of Alaska at that time, as this was our administration of any land owned by the United States up north of you know, the South 48 structure, not associated with the Hawaiian Islands. But we researched all of the islands going out along the Aleutians. We researched all of the islands that were associated with the offshore areas. Were there anything that was not within the description conveying to the state of Alaska all the lands claimed by the United States? And I can tell you that the Wrangell Islands and the group out there was never raised by anyone. Although we knew what the Lomans had done, you know, they had had a very decided relationship to those islands in transferring animals from Siberia. No one ever raised at that time a claim on behalf of the United States to those islands. So my answer is that I wish I could put it in the light vein. Howard Baker used to say, if you haven't got a dog in that fight, keep out of it. That Alaskans don't have a dog in that fight. Now, if another group wants to say that's property of the United States and take on an issue, fine. But Alaskans don't belong in that fight, because we got all of the land that was associated with Alaska turned over to the state in terms of the definition of the territory. We didn't get the ownership, but anything that the United States owned in this area was put within the state of Alaska. And at that time, no one claimed ownership to those islands. So I again say, you know, I'm following Howard's advice. I got other dogs, got some tough fights, and I don't need that one. So.
Representative Perry, John?
Senator Stevens, on this question of oil, the price of oil, that's obviously on our minds very much every day down here in Juneau. I've heard and read about the possibility of an oil import tax. As the price of oil continues to decline, this might be a way to raise revenue and increase our domestic production. Is this talk serious? Is it going to get more serious as the price either declines further or stabilizes at the local place it is? How is that going to affect the Alaskan production?
Senator Alford.
Mr. President, the Senate will convene in our chambers upon adjournment of the joint session. I move and ask unanimous consent that joint session stand adjourned.
No objection. The joint session is adjourned.
Would the House chambers are being cleared.
Control mechanism on imports and at the same time stabilize our domestic prices. We got shot down, frankly. I can tell you, you know, in my judgment, it would be virtually impossible to get through the Congress a bill to impose an import tax on oil. The president has that power by existing law if he wants to impose it. Few people recall that President Nixon did put it into effect once, and it had very little impact, except it brought about a great deal of antagonism and led to the enactment of the oil control legislation that later did a lot of harm to Alaska and other oil-producing states. As a consequence, the international oil industry is against the oil import tax. There's a group of people who are now suggesting a gasoline tax increase, and I don't think that'll get through either. I really don't believe that we'll turn to either one of those for increased revenues right now, and I'm sure you've heard what the president said about any increased taxation. So, in my judgment, it's something you just can't bank on, although I still believe it's a mechanism to control imports. And as such, rather than a mechanism for raising revenue, it's a valid one.
One more question, Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Stephen, really pleased to have you with us today and discuss so many questions that affect all of us on a national and international. One of the things that I was concerned about has to do with sovereignty of states And we were all pleased some time ago when Congress announced, and you announced, Senator Murkowski, that there was a local hire provision in our military contracts. However, just a few weeks ago, we found out that there was a footnote to that that kind of gave exclusive rights to union workers from out of state who would be considered Alaskan residents if they were called through the union halls to come out of here up to Alaska. As you know, that we're very concerned about Alaska's rights and first hires on many jobs. And union workers are concerned about that, too, because many of their brothers in 302 or Tacoma or Tulsa have seniority over that. And if they go by their union rules, they would then be considered first hire if this instant residency is implemented. And also, we have a lot of non-union workers that may want those jobs, too. A major concern is what right does Congress have to circumvent the sovereignty of any state as to who will be a resident of that state?
Well, you know, I wrote that. I was trying to protect the amendment against attack. It's going to be subject to attack. I was informed this last week anyway. But the problem was is that in the dispatching procedure from the union halls, there are many people who are eligible for dispatching who are Alaska residents at the time that they are entered into the book, who might return to South 48, Seattle, or somewhere else, and if they're back in the area by the time their name comes up, they are eligible for dispatch, even though they may not have been here 30 days again. And we were trying to protect against the interstate commerce problem that we got into in the Sobel case. In terms of that amendment, and I think it does protect it. If you think about it, it did not say you have to be a union member to be dispatched. It says that if you are dispatched by in the normal procedures from a union hall, that is proof of residency, and I think that that was necessary in order to protect the amendment that we sought to get through. That amendment, as you know, does require the local hire concept to be applied to the expenditure of defense funds for contracts in the state of Alaska. It will be attacked, I understand, by a group of people from Seattle here soon, we will finally get a test of that. I hope they do attack it, and I hope that we get a test of it, because with the current changes going on in Washington, it would be very hard to get that extended for next year. In a declining defense budget, I'm sure you realize it's awful hard to put on a condition which imposes such local hire requirements. But I put it in this year's because of the tremendous increase in expenditures associated with the light division. There's some $300 million there, and we thought that could attach to that money, and we thought we could get a test of whether or not we could in the future put such a provision into federal law and make it enforceable as far as the protection of a state. Don't forget, it's tied to unemployment, and it's tied to conditions that I think make it constitutional. The one thing we feared was the part you're mentioning. What do you do about someone who has a valid right to be the next person to be dispatched under, if the contractor has a union agreement, and the next person to be dispatched from that hall is a person who was validly entitled to be recognized as a resident at the time his name went on, or her name went on the book, but has left the state and now comes back and wants to be dispatched in accordance with the union procedure, and someone comes along and says, wait a minute, you're not a resident. You haven't been here for the last 30 days. This isn't your permanent home. You haven't been here 30 days. Now, we protected against that claim, and I think made the amendment immune from that type of attack legally. It is subject to a constitutional attack on the basis of whether or not it's an impediment to interstate commerce and within the power of the Congress to impose that kind of condition on the expenditure money. I hope there is an attack, and I hope we're successful, and I think if we are, that you all will have an example to follow in terms of following the expenditure of state money in the state of Alaska. Because I believe that the government that spends the money has the right to put such conditions on the expenditures so long as there are justifications such as the difference in unemployment and similar concepts. Thank you all. I see that my friend down here is getting fidgety, and he has the attention of my friend who I shall remember this introduction for a long time. It's nice to be with you all. Thank you very much.
before the at-ease, prior to the joint session, we had a motion before us to accept the journal for the 52nd and the 53rd legislative day. That motion was withdrawn. Representative Clarkson?
I'm just going to point out do you wish to have it taken up again now or under unfinished business?
There was no motion to that effect. Representative Clarkson, make the motion.
Why don't you just tell me what you'd like, Mr. Speaker?
Okay.
We can either do it now or wait till after the calendar under unfinished business.
Mr. Majority Leader, let's do it right now.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the journal for the 52nd and 53rd day in Journal Supplement 94 be approved as certified.
Okay. We have objections to that motion. Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. With your normal leniency on a little open discussion on it, my major concern has to do so with the giving of limited powers to the conference committee pertaining to Senate Bill 187. And the reason, sir, is that I spoke at the end of the clerk's reading of all the messages and reports deliberately, not at that time. I didn't want to be disrupted in her normal flow of reading. But I did ask for a point of information pertaining to the appropriateness of the meeting that was called, having not heard of any posted meeting to that conference. And especially on Rule 42 pertaining to conference committee, sir, and Rule 22 pertaining to open meetings, that they will be announced. Now, in the, and I don't want to go through the debate, but we do have the word-by-word description from the House chair of that conference committee that told us what did take place, and that evidently there was an agreement before the meeting to have the meeting, and then at the meeting itself, they asked for free conference power, not limited, and correctly so, it was corrected to limited free powers. The point was, sir, is that it was an illegal meeting under Rule 22 and 140 and Rule 42. Now, we made an assumption by the end of the statement, sir, that it can be interpreted a couple of ways, but when I re-emphasized, was there a formal announcement of the hearing? And we only got some jargon about that there will be an announcement about the next hearing, which doesn't matter. I was talking about the first hearing, and it makes it very clear. In this case, it said that you concluded, sir, that was the case, and it will be definitely published. Well, in a journal, we have nothing published about the prior meeting that they held, supposedly for about 30 seconds at 8:30 in the morning. And I feel that they were given a limited power for a conference committee on the assumption that it was a legal meeting, on the assumption that they did follow Rule 42 as to what will be the criteria under which a conference committee were asked for limited powers. And I'm asking now that perhaps we should reevaluate that before we get into a president, and you've done very good last year, the majority has done very good last year, and made sure all conference committees gave us reports and gave us the understanding of why those conference committees felt they needed limited powers. Now, this is the first conference committee, I think, that we've established this year, and I hate to see us go into the wrong direction. And even with all the honesties and mistakes and things like that, I just take it as perhaps an honest mistake. They were in a hurry to get this thing rolling along, but we still have to fight for the integrity of the process and the rules. And I'd like to ask that you suspend the limited free conference until that time when there is published notice of the first conference committee.
Had the representative made a point of order at that time, then the chair would have had to make a decision. But as it was a question of parliamentary inquiry. Thus, that inquiry now is carried over into the 54th legislative day, of which I felt there was an answer. And I think the proper thing would be point of order. Perhaps we have passed that stage. In other words, the chair cannot make a decision unless it's a point of order, not on a parliamentary inquiry. Representative Miller.
I was just going to enumerate the very point you just made. The time for discussing this would have been yesterday when a point of order should have been made. The
What we're doing today is merely certifying what happened. We're certifying the journal. We can't go back and retroactively play like we did something other than what we did. So even if what we did yesterday was illegal, which it was not, but even if we did something illegal yesterday, what we did has to appear in the journal. And it's the only written record of our actions. And so, therefore, objection to the certification of the journal is not the proper course, as you mentioned, Mr. Speaker. The point of order should have been raised. The point of order was not raised. And, of course, now under Mason's, the opportunity for raising that point is passed.
Representative Martin.
Mr. Speaker, the first question in parliamentary procedures, so that we do not get into a discussion of point of order, which is always offensive, is to ask for point of information. And upon the information that was obtained from the House chairman, it was assumed that there was the proper orders followed, Rule 42 and Rule 22. So in that case, by the assumption made in this statement by himself that's on record, and the assumption, sir, in conclusion, that was the case, and it will be definitely published, then I can now raise a point of order, perhaps now. I didn't want to be rude, as I mentioned before, and I don't like to jump up, as we've seen in before, people yelling point of orders and arguing everything else before we even know what the case is. I thought it would be more polite to check the records out to see what did happen or did not happen and to bring it up at the next session. And so we see that assumptions were made that were not true. And I would dispute with the gentleman from Juneau that you can never make anything legal that was illegal to begin with. There was no announcement, sir, of that meeting, and it makes it an illegal meeting.
I think, Representative Martin, what we're referring to is that you asked for a parliamentary inquiry. And during that parliamentary inquiry, which could have led to a point of order, which could have caused the chair to delay that decision to a future date, such as today, to render a decision, then it would be appropriate. But the time has passed for a point of order in relation to the acceptance of the legislative journal. At the same time, the chair did indicate to you that if this was the case, that the chairmen who are chairing free conferences should announce, preferably on the floor, that they are going to be meeting in free conference. And I assured you that if that was the case, that it would not happen again. And I think most chairmen or anybody here who potentially might be a chairman of a free conference committee would make sure that announcement shall be given. Your point, Representative, is well taken and definitely understood by this body, that this is a serious matter. This is our first conference committee, and perhaps something did happen. But this body will see to it that it will not happen again if that is the case. Representative Clarkson.
Mr. Speaker, I don't want to prolong this. I was not here when the original point was raised, but as I understand the objection by the minority leader, it was because there was no written public notice of a proposed meeting of the conference committee. Is that what this is all about?
Mr. Minority Leader.
Mr. Chairman, there was no notice to my mind of any indication, verbal, announcement, written. I talked to the Senate leader just that afternoon. He told me he was going to wait for some very legitimate concerns that he has from legal service. I know there was a lady who told me after the fact that she had called the House chairman. The House chairman told her he will let her know when the conference committee meets. I don't know who she is. She lives here in Juneau. But I know her name now. And she felt very offended in knowing that there was a committee hearing without even being notified after being promised that it was.
The only decision before this House is to approve the journal for the 52nd and the 53rd legislative day, plus the journal. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. If there is any fault in this, it is mine. And I apologize to one and all if that occurred. There was no intent. I am familiar with Rule 42, which provides that in a conference committee, the committee members meet at a time, the wording is, when mutually agreeable to its members. The provisions, the five-day notice provisions of Rule 23 don't apply. I have passed out to the members the minutes of that meeting and also the request for limited powers of free conference. The one power we've requested is the one power, the one issue that is really dividing the two houses, and that is the mechanism by which an adult adoptee can learn the identity of his or her parents. And that is the issue. And for the information of the body, specifically anybody who is interested, the meeting that we will have, and if I may, Mr. Speaker, I'd like to announce it now, will be next Tuesday at 10. And that was supposed to be in the calendar today. I don't see it in here. I will make certain it is in the calendar tomorrow. The lady who was mentioned is a friend of mine. I talked to her personally. I have instructed my staff to tell her. They have tried several times to contact that lady, and I will make certain she is notified, and anyone else. And for the information of the body, the distinguished minority leader and the distinguished chairman of the Judiciary Committee and I and the chairman of the Senate conferees had an informal discussion and meeting with a number of people all day on Saturday, last Saturday by teleconference on this. We have had a lot of input. We are going to try to accommodate all. Thank you.
Okay, once again, the chair may not make a decision from a parliamentary inquiry. The proper motion would have been a point of order. That time now has passed. I think we have reached an understanding as to the question and the concern by Representative Martin. Representative Clarkson.
Mr. Speaker, I agree with you that we've reached an understanding. I just want to make it clear that that understanding is that no rule was violated by the chair of the conference committee in this regard. There is no rule that requires advance public notice of those meetings. It has been a courtesy of this body for years to provide those. Maybe the rule should provide that notice, but no rule has been violated by the chair of that conference committee.
Just want to state that.
Last response, Mr. Majority Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with you on the approval of the journal, but I do want to make it very clear for the majority leader and any other leader, Rule 22, and I will pass out to you from Ms. Pam Cook, the Division of Legal Services, making it very clear that Rule 22 had been violated, and also Mason's rules, and I'll get that one for you, too.
Do we still have objections in relation to accepting or approving the journal for the 52nd and 53rd legislative day, and I believe there was a supplement? Are the objections maintained? Hearing no objections, the journal and the supplement stand approved. Thank you, Mr. Minority Leader. Do we have any guests for introduction at this time? Representative Hurley.
Mr. Speaker, in Gallery B today, we have the a constituent of Representative Larson's and mine, who is the activist for seniors in our state. Please help me welcome Rose Palmquist.
Representative Navarre.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce a friend of mine and a constituent from the Kenai Peninsula, and he's on the Borough Assembly, Mr. Brent Keene, in Gallery A.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's my pleasure to introduce to the body a constituent of mine from Kodiak, the director of our Senior Citizen Center, and also a member of the Kodiak Island Borough School Board, Mr. Dennis Murray.
Representative Taylor.
Yes, in Gallery B, directly behind me, we have the immediate past president of our Ketchikan School Board, also the current president-elect of the State School Boards Association, and I'd like you to welcome with me Ms. Sherry Davis.
Any further guests for introduction? This brings us down to messages from the governor.
Dear Representative Grusendorf, I have signed the following and I'm transmitting the engrossed and enrolled copies to the Lieutenant Governor's Office for permanent filing. Senate Joint Resolution Number 30 relating to passenger service by Korean Airlines in Anchorage, Legislative Resolve Number 33, and Committee Substitute for House Bill 118 Judiciary relating to small claims and the duties of magistrates and providing for an effective date, Chapter Number 3, SLA 1986. Signed sincerely, Bill Sheffield, Governor. I have no further messages from the Governor, Mr. Speaker.
Messages from the Senate.
The Senate has approved the following citations, and they are transmitted for consideration. In Memoriam J. Stouter by Senators Vic Fisher, Josephson, and Halford, and Representative Clarkson, and honoring Esther C. Wenicke by Senators Vic Fisher, Kelly, Ziegler, Ferencamp, Zharoff, Sturgiluski, Paul Fisher, Rody Bennett, Halford, DeVries, Coghill, Eliason, Fakes, Gratula, Abood, and Ray. And the Senate approved the following citation, and it has been transmitted to enrolling. In Memoriam, Myrtle R. Thomas.
Those citations for the House consideration will be placed in rules for our for calendaring.
Mr. Speaker, the President granted limited powers of free conference to the Senate Conference Committee considering Senate Bill 187 and House Committee substitute for Senate Bill 187, Second Judiciary, on adoption with an effective date as follows. Access to adoption information for adult adoptees. I have no further messages from the Senate, Mr. Speaker.
Do we have any other communications that should come before this body?
We've received a notice of proposed changes to the regulations of the Board of Dental Examiners, and also we've received a from Esther Wenicke, Commissioner of Natural Resources, responding to legislative intent language in the Fiscal Year 1986 Appropriation Act. These communications are on file in the Speaker's office. I have no further communications, Mr. Speaker.
This brings us down to reports of standing committees.
The Hess Committee has considered committee substitute for Senate Bill 67, Judiciary, relating to arrest by a peace officer without a warrant and service of process in cases of domestic violence, recommends it be replaced with House Committee substitute for committee substitute for Senate Bill 67, Hess, with the same title, and that it do pass and attaches a zero fiscal note. The report was signed by the co-chairs Gruenberg and Kopanen. Signing do pass, Gruenberg, Kopanen, Taylor, Hurley, Pettijohn, and Thompson. Senate Bill 67 as a further referral to the Judiciary Committee. The State Affairs Committee has considered House Concurrent Resolution 47, establishing a joint special committee on state employee compensation, recommends it do pass and attaches a zero fiscal note. The report was signed by Hurley Chairman, concurring Hurley, Jenkins, and Cato, having no recommendation, M.M. Miller and Collins. House Concurrent Resolution number 47 has a further referral to the Finance Committee. The Hess Committee has considered House Concurrent Resolution number 50, establishing a joint committee on mental health trust land, and recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Concurrent Resolution 50, Hess, with the same title, recommends it do pass and attaches a fiscal note. Report was signed by the co-chairs, Kopanen and Gruenberg. Concurring, Kopanen, Gruenberg, Taylor, Pettijohn, Thompson, and Hurley. House Concurrent Resolution 50 has a further referral to the Finance Committee. The Committee on Judiciary has had House Bill 194, sentencing for certain offenses involving discriminatory harassment, under consideration, recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 194, Judiciary, with a new title, recommends it do pass and attaches a fiscal note, a zero fiscal note. The report was signed by M.M. Miller, Chairman, concurring, M.M. Miller, Sun, Gruenberg, Phillips, and Clarkson. Signing do not pass, Taylor. Having no recommendation, Pettijohn. House Bill 194 has a further referral to the Finance Committee. The Resources Committee has considered House Bill 355, authorizing the establishment and implementation of onboard observer programs, recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 355, Fisheries, with the same title, recommends it do pass and attaches a zero fiscal note. The report was signed by Herman, co-chair. Signing do pass, Herman, M.W. Miller, Thompson, Cato, Jenkins, Pierce, and Wallace. Sun signs no recommendation, needs amendment. House Bill 355 has a further referral to the Finance Committee. The Labor and Commerce Committee has considered House Bill 430, regulating audiologists, hearing aid dealers, and the dispensing of hearing aids, recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 430, Labor and Commerce, with the same title, and that it do pass and attaches a zero fiscal note with analysis. The report was signed by Navarre Chairman, concurring Navarre, Kopanen, and Hanley, Collins, Boucher, Pierce, and Davis. House Bill 430 has a further referral to the Hess Committee. The Transportation Committee has considered House Bill 436, requiring a properly equipped and staffed caboose on certain trains, recommends it do pass. The report was signed by Cato Chairman, concurring Cato, Pinalberry, Herman, and Furness. Maru signs do not pass, conflicts with federal law, and Davis has no recommendation. House Bill 436 has no further referral. The Finance Committee has considered House Bill 479 relating to biomass fuel systems, recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 479, Labor and Commerce, with the same title, recommends it do pass and attaches a new zero fiscal note. The report was signed by Adams Chairman, concurring Adams, Ringstead, Duncan, Frank, Cotton, Porchot, Zemanski, Larson, Ewling, and Rieger. House Bill 479 appears on today's calendar. The Resources Committee has considered House Bill 492, relating to sport fishing from commercially licensed troll vessels, recommends it do pass, and also recommends further further referral to the Rules Committee. The report was signed by Herman, co-chair, signing DuPass, M.W. Miller, Jenkins, Herman, Cato, and Sund. Having no recommendation, Wallace, Pierce, Schultz, and Thompson. House Bill 492 has no further referral. The Judiciary Committee has considered House Bill 493, making corrective amendments to the Alaska statutes as recommended by the revisor of statutes, and that recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 493, Judiciary, with the same title, and that it do pass and attaches a sectional analysis and a zero fiscal note. The report was signed by M.M. Miller, Chairman, concurring, M.M. Miller, Sun, Grunberg, Taylor, Pettijohn, and Phillips. House Bill 493 appears on today's calendar. The Transportation Committee has considered House Bill 355 relating to state toll facilities, recommends it do pass and attaches a zero fiscal note. The report was signed by Cato, Chairman, concurring, Cato, Herman, Furness, Davis, and Pinyalberry. House Bill 555 has a further referral to the Finance Committee. The Labor and Commerce Committee has considered House Bill 603 relating to dispensing opticians, recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 603, Labor and Commerce, with the same title, and that it do pass and attaches a new fiscal note. The report was signed by Navarre, Chairman, concurring, Navarre, Davis, Copen and Hanley, Collins, Boucher, and Pierce. House Bill 603 has no further referral. The Resources Committee has considered House Bill 605, establishing the Shuyak State Game Refuge, recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 605, Resources, with the same title, and that it do pass and attaches 2-0 fiscal notes. The report was signed by Herman, co-chair, concurring, Schultz, Cato, M.W. Miller, Thompson, Sun, Pierce, Jenkins, and Herman. Wallace has no recommendation. House Bill 605 has a further referral to the Finance Committee. The State Affairs Committee has considered House Bill 676, relating to implementation of a classification study for the classified service of state employees, recommends reports it back as follows with the new fiscal note. The report was signed by Hurley, Chairman, signing DuPass, Hurley, and M.M. Miller. Having no recommendation, Jenkins, Collins, and Cato. House Bill 676 has a further referral to the Finance Committee. I have no further standing committee reports, Mr. Speaker.
Reports of special committees.
The House Special Committee on Oil and Gas has had sponsor substitute for House Bill 339 relating to the limitation of municipal oil and gas production and pipeline property taxes to pay for bonds under consideration, recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for sponsor substitute for House Bill 339 Oil and Gas with a new title, reports it back as follows with a first fiscal note. Report was signed by Davis, Chairman, signing DuPass, Maru, and Pinyalberry. Having no recommendation, Szymanski, Cotton, Davis, and Porchot. Sponsor substitute for House Bill 339 as a further referral to the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. The House Special Committee on Telecommunications has considered House Bill 539 relating to reduced rates and discounted service for low-income telecommunication customers and recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 539 Telecommunications with the same title and that it do pass and attaches 3-0 fiscal notes. The report was signed by Thompson, Vice Chair, signing DuPass, Thompson, Wallace, Hanley, and Collins. House Bill 539 has a further referral to the State Affairs Committee. The House Special Committee on Oil and Gas has considered House Bill 572, Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, recommends it do pass. The report was signed by Davis, Chairman, signing do pass, Cotton, Pinyalberry, Davis, and Szymanski. Maru has no recommendation. House Bill 572 has a further referral to the Finance Committee. I have no further special committee reports, Mr. Speaker.
This brings it, Representative Gall.
May we stand at ease, please, Mr. Speaker?
The House, please stand at ease. Will the House come back to order? Before the at ease, we had just completed reports of special committees. This brings us down to introduction of citations and resolutions.
Citations for introduction, Mr. Speaker, and no resolutions for introduction.
This brings us down to introduction, first reading, and reference of House bills.
Sponsor substitute for House Bill 637 by Taylor, an act relating to state support for education and providing for an effective date.
The referrals on this will be Health, Education, and Social Services and the Finance Committee. Representative Thompson, were you seeking the floor?
Speaker, I wanted to introduce an additional guest.
Are there any objections moving back up the calendar to introduction of guests? Hearing none, proceed, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I regret an oversight on my part. I did not introduce the body to our guest page today, who is a constituent of mine from Kodiak, Ms. Danica Thomas.
Without objections of this body, we have located some citations for introduction. Are there any objections moving back up to introduction of citations and resolutions? Hearing none, would the clerk please read those?
Citation honoring Mary McKinnon by Representative Grunberg. Citation honoring Soldotna High School's academic decathlon team by Representatives Navarre and Kopanen. Citation in memoriam Dorothy D. Tyner by Representatives Grunberg, Taylor, and Senators Ziegler and Josephson. Citation in memoriam Lucille M. Young by Representative Grunberg. I have no further citations, Mr. Speaker.
Those citations will be referred to rules for calendaring. This brings us down to the consideration of the daily calendar. The clerk, please read the first item on today's calendar.
House Bill 479 by Duncan, an act relating to biomass fuel systems. The Labor and Commerce Committee has considered House Bill 479, recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 479, Labor and Commerce, with the same title, and that it do pass, and attaches a zero fiscal note with analysis. The report was signed by Navarre Chairman, concurring Navarre, Kopen, and Hanley, Pierce, Collins, Boucher, and Davis. The House Special Committee on State Loans has considered the bill and recommends it do pass. The report was signed by Sun Chairman, concurring Sun, Duncan, and Euling. Signing no recommendation, Cotton. The Finance Committee has considered House Bill 479, recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 479, Labor and Commerce, with the same title, and that it do pass and attaches a zero fiscal note. The report was signed by Adams Chairman, concurring Adams, Ringstead, Duncan, Frank, Cotton, Porchot, Zemanski, Larson, Euling, and Rieger. I have one committee substitute on my desk, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Clarkson.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent the Labor and Commerce Committee substitute for House Bill 479 be considered in lieu of the original bill.
Are there any objections to the adoption of the committee substitute, Labor and Commerce? Hearing no objections, the committee substitute has been adopted. Does the clerk have any further amendments upon her desk?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Clarkson.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent the Labor and Commerce Committee substitute for House Bill 479 be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final passage.
Are there any objections to the advancement motion from second to third reading? Hearing no objection, would the clerk please read the title of that bill?
Committee substitute for House Bill 479, Labor and Commerce, by the Labor and Commerce Committee, an act relating to biomass fuel systems.
Is there any debate?
Question.
Representative Maru.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Once again, we have a specious zero fiscal note. I don't know how we can expand a loan program and have a zero fiscal note. The very meaning of expanding a loan program is to loan out more money. This whole thing sounds like a good thing to promote, but my question is, should the state be in the energy loan business? This apparently has to do with a wood smoke problem. The wood smoke problem is certainly a local concern that municipalities, in my opinion, should offer incentive zone, not the state. I hope we all realize that the cleanest burning fuel of all is the simplest hydrocarbon, methane, otherwise known as natural gas, of which Alaska has virtually infinite amounts. Perhaps if we are concerned about pollution of the air, we should be burning methane. Now, on the bill, and I hope someone is paying attention, as far as I can tell, the bill is internally contradictory. Line 11, page 1, says, an energy which is not dependent on oil or gas.